Our next case of the morning is number 05-1902, the United States against John M. Shamus. Mr. Beavers.
May I please the court? I think one of the important issues regarding this substantial risk of harm enhancement is to look at how it fits into the whole guideline structure.
Which are advisory, as we know.
Yes, but as we deal with statutory interpretation, I think it is important to see how big an enhancement it is. If we look at the smallest level of methamphetamine that could be made would be at level 12. If it's done in a manner that calls this enhancement into question, that makes this enhancement apply, it bumps it up to level 27. Assuming the person pleads guilty and has no criminal history, that would increase the range from a 0 to 6 month offense up to a 41 to 51 month offense. This is clearly a major enhancement, and I think the wording has to be interpreted with that in mind. And I think taking that in mind, it is also important in evaluating what standard of review this court will apply to evaluate appeals of that guideline enhancement.
I want to ask you something about the fundamental theory that you're suggesting, which is, as I understand it, that if the enhancement applied to the facts that the district court judge found here, it basically applies, you know, to everything, you know, maybe the one in a million meth lab that's sitting in the middle of the field, or something. And I just wonder why, in a sense, that would be wrong. We read constantly about methamphetamine manufacturing, you know, operations in people's kitchens, you know, blowing up or catching on fire. It's actually a fairly dangerous enterprise. So when the guideline 2D1.1D6B says if it involves the manufacture of methamphetamine creates a substantial risk of harm to human life, what reason do we have to think that the drafters of the guidelines thought that was going to be unusual?
Well, Your Honor, the mere fact that they put it in there suggests that the Guidelines Commission is distinguishing between two types of methamphetamine manufacturing processes, or two types of ways to do it. And I think that is whether there's a substantial risk or not, it's a legal issue as to how much is a substantial risk of harm. As it's clear that methamphetamine manufacturing would always be dangerous to some extent, but the guidelines in that case would have just made methamphetamine manufacture itself dangerous rather than
Are you drawing a distinction at all between things that are a substantial risk of harm generally and a potentially lethal risk?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that is an issue that has not been addressed by this court or, in fact, any of the courts as to whether it's a deadly risk. And I think when you look at the base offense for when this enhancement applies to methamphetamine manufacture at offense level 27, it is the same level as aggravated assault with a firearm, which causes a life-threatening injury as offense level 26. And I think that gives some idea about why it's so high, that is because it's lethal risk. There's always a risk that you might burn your hand or something when this happens. That's the lower category in my understanding. And I think that because it is a matter of risk and establishing how much risk, I think there is a serious danger that if the court does not apply the de novo mixed law fact standard of review, that all judges will essentially be applying this incredibly large enhancement in different ways, depending on what they think subjectively is a big or small risk.
What evidence is there here that the district court was focusing on risk to life as opposed to other risk? And the last sentence sort of repeats the guidelines, but what facts did the court find that show risk to life?
I don't find that she found any, and I think that's the problem. The government hasn't suggested any. I think what she mentions in her holding is that these are toxic and volatile chemicals, but the evidence only shows that the eyewitness who came in says that it didn't cause his eyes to water and it didn't cause him to cough, but on other occasions he had been in circumstances of meth manufacturing where it did. But I think that in connection with the government's other evidence, which is that this was a second gassing, which is the hydrochloric acid process only, not the typical and necessary anhydrous ammonia process, which, as you correctly point out, we know, and methamphetamine manufacturing, you always hear it's dangerous. Their evidence proved, I think, very strongly that methamphetamine made with anhydrous can be, under the circumstances described in the report, the kind of danger to human life which this enhancement applies to. The problem is that the government's own test itself says, on page 3 of the test, says that very little is known about the specific exposure hazards faced by the illegal methamphetamine manufacturing. So they do the test. They prove that ammonia anhydrous is extremely dangerous to human life, but the test fails on the hydrochloric acid part, so we don't know yet.
Which is the procedure involved here?
She says in the sentencing transcript, you know, I agree that I don't give this enhancement every time you have a methamphetamine case, and I agree that you put anhydrous in the ground, but when you make methamphetamine in a small trailer in a trailer park, it's giving off that gas that's creating clouds and other odors that cause people to have to get outside quickly so to breathe without having problems with actual breathing, and you're dealing with toxic substances, as they clearly were, and further volatile substances. I think the facts outlined in those paragraphs of the pre-sentence report do support a finding that the incident was offensive, relevant conduct for a substantial risk of life. I mean, she says she doesn't give it every time.
That's correct, but I think, and I think that it is, what has happened is she's saying she's not giving it in every time if it's outdoors, and that's not absolutely conclusive, but I think the problem is that there was no evidence to show that the chemicals involved here were toxic or volatile. That in general, as a general process, the whole process might be dangerous, but I think...
There wasn't there a testimony from one of the officers that he couldn't breathe?
Well, Your Honor, the actual testimony, he was asked if he... if it caused him... He caused his eyes to water. He said no. Did it cause him to cough? No. And he left because he had been in places, other places, where he had stayed too long and became queasy. So, but what we don't know is were those anhydrous process, which would, based on the study, be likely to cause serious harm.
If the enhancement was, do we get to a reasonableness analysis here? If we find the enhancement proper. In other words, the enhancement could take place.
Oh, whether it would be reasonable?
I don't think either counsel addressed the reasonableness in with regard to the sentencing aspect of that. He didn't, and I don't think the government did either.
No, and I believe that this, the issue of reasonableness is linked to this enhancement because the risk of harm and the distinguishing between very dangerous types of methamphetamine is the guidelines, I think, set out a very good guideline for what would be a reasonable sentence in this case. If it is proved to be dangerous, I think the type of enhancement, the sentence would be appropriate. If it's not, I believe it wouldn't be reasonable because it would conflict with other defendants.
Okay.
Thank you. That is my time button, Rick.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Beavers. Now for Mr. Sanchez.
May it please the court, Mr. Beavers. My name is Esteban Sanchez. I represent the United States in this cause. If a white fog engulfed this courtroom, and the courtroom was also permeated with a strong smell of ether, I doubt that very few of us in this courtroom here would stay, because we would reach the conclusion that that is not a safe condition to our health, and that it would cause some serious or substantial harm to our lives.
Well, that's the line I'm interested in, Mr. Sanchez. I mean, I'm not sure how we go about drawing it, but there definitely are some things that are bad for your health that, at least in ordinary discourse, we wouldn't think of as life-threatening. As I read this guideline enhancement, it seems to be a fairly deliberate choice on the part of the drafters of the commission to focus on harm to human life in the environment. We're not worried about the environment here. So harm to human life. How do you draw that line? Is everything that's harmful in general also harmful to life? Or is there some difference in the language the commission's using?
Your Honor, I think that because in this instance the commission do the difference between substantially harmful to human life and life itself, or causing death, that anything that would injure a person could be interpreted to mean harmful to human life.
Then why did they use that phrase instead of their more common phrase, substantial risk of serious harm, which of course they have in quite a few other places in the guidelines?
I do not know the answer to that, but I would suggest to the court that that's what they meant, because they do draw the distinction between substantial risk or harm to human life and life, as in there being imminent death or resulting in imminent death.
What are you referring to? Because the guideline refers to creating a substantial risk of harm to one human life other than a life described in subsection C, or two, the environment. And then there's this four-factor test, which the district court didn't seem to have really gone through.
They did not say imminent. I guess what I meant to say was that they did not go that step further, which is what the court, I think, is suggesting, that there has to be an imminent danger of death. They said substantial risk of harm
to human life. I mean, I guess that's what I'm thinking. If risk of harm to life means death, I understand it. If risk of harm to life means something other than death, it seems like a bit of a stretch.
Well, there would be risk of life, I would think, if somebody is injured as a result of, or has suffered some respiratory serious illness as a result of inhaling chemicals. There's a risk of life to human life, and that it would impair the life. It would probably even reduce the life expectancy of that person.
Has any court, to your knowledge, interpreted this guideline to say that it's about life expectancy?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. In this case, Judge Scott's ruling in the application of the enhancement should be affirmed. And the reason it should be affirmed is because she was correct in two things. In concluding that there was, in fact, a risk of harm to human life in this case, because the defendant was manufacturing methamphetamine in a small trailer in a trailer park, using chemicals that were, one, dangerous to those who are exposed to them, and who were also volatile and explosive in nature.
What record did she have that the hydrochloric acid, other than perhaps if you poured it on your hand, it might burn you? Did she have any record of respiratory failure from exposure to that or anything?
There was nothing on the record with regard to that, other than the testimony of Officer Burke that said that he and the other officer had to be to move outside because the strong odor of ether that was emanating from the trailer was so strong that based upon past experience where he had been in similar situations, in similar meth labs in small confined places, had caused him to become ill, queasy, coughing, hard breathing, hard to breathe, etc. And rather than stay there until that happened, he moved outside.
Yes.
But
what about the application note 20 questions? Is there any problem with the district courts not having, you know, considered, for example, how many of the other trailers were, or the duration and extent of the offense and the operation, and all these other things?
Well, Your Honor, no, I do not think so. First, in reading the 20A, application note 28, it doesn't say that these are the only things that the court can consider. It says the court shall include its consideration the following factors. The location. The court noted that this was in a trailer park and noted that by the number 17 at Hammond Trailer Park, which was the address of this particular trailer. So just as there were other trailers in the trailer park, I think.
But surely it would matter if they were, you know, 10 feet apart or 100 yards apart. Do we have any idea?
There's nothing on the record with regard to that. I think it is fair to assume or to reason that the typical trailer parking in central Illinois, in Taylor, Illinois in particular, it's pretty like cramped trailer park. There's not acres between trailer parks. But being that as it may, Your Honor, if you read the transcript on page 110 and 111 of Judge Scott's findings in this matter, assuming that I have the same page number in what you do, it's clear that Judge Scott mentioned that this is explosive material that we're looking at all over this trailer. But her primary focus was on this white fog and this ether that permeated this trailer and how it affected the people that were there and how Officer Burke testified that he had to be removed. The location and that impact. She did not say had this thing which she didn't see, or she didn't specifically rely upon that this is a dangerous situation. I mean, we could explore it, we could have created a danger to others, but look at this white flower that's here, which, in my opinion, renders Towns' argument really new. The fact that we were only putting a small amount of methamphetamine.
We were also storing the stuff in the trailer.
Absolutely, yes. There was this chemical flowing over the trailer in open containers. Some of them had already been used and they were just disposed there in the trailer, etc. But this argument that because they were putting a small amount of methamphetamine, this enhancement shouldn't apply, doesn't matter, or that they were using ammonia at that particular part of the cooking process, doesn't matter, or that there was a second gassing of the, or blowing off of these, it doesn't matter.
Was there any evidence as to who lived in the trailer or what their ages were?
Yes. There was an individual who was an adult,
mm-hmm.
who was the one that actually called the police to say, there are some people in my trailer, and I'm afraid to go back in my trailer, and they're cooking meth at this time. And that's how the police got there. But he was an adult. I don't believe that there was any evidence of any other person living there in that trailer.
Do you have any evidence of children living in the area?
Not specifically, Your Honor, no.
Or elderly people?
We can only assume that in the trailer park, there are other families living in those trailers, Your Honor.
There was at least an oblique reference to that by the trial judge, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes. If I may conclude my thought, in response of his argument that the enhancement shouldn't apply when there's only a small amount of methamphetamine, as we can see, even a small amount of methamphetamine, production of a small amount of methamphetamine creates a substantial hazard and danger to health.
Well, this is certainly dangerous. I don't think there's any.
Mr. Sanchez, I asked your opposing counsel about the reasonableness analysis. Is that implicated here? I mean, do you have to look at the reasonableness of the sentence?
Well, I believe that under the Booker and Melvin decisions, yes, you do, but a sentence within the sentencing guideline range is presumed to be reasonable. And in this case, the court imposed the very lowest sentence you could impose within the guideline range, which was 168 to 210 months, and she imposed a sentence of 168 months. I see that my time is up. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Sanchez. Sir, your time had expired. If you'd like a minute, if there's something on your mind, you may have a minute.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out in response to the question that that you asked the in Appendix 23, Appendix page 23 of my brief, it shows how the government study showed that anhydrous ammonia would have a risk of pulmonary edema and death, could cause death. And in contrast, the next page shows that hydrochloric acid mist could cause maybe asthma, things like that. Nothing in there seemed to have any risk of death in it.
Asthma is just a drop in the bucket. Not important. Asthma is not important.
Well, no, it's important, but it's not risk of harm to human life. Had they used the aid, it wouldn't be a harm to human life. It wouldn't be a risk of death in that sense, a substantial risk of death. The risk that someone could develop asthma by itself, I would not consider that.
As you said, sir, neither you nor I are physicians.
That's correct. But in the study, it says that the methamphetamine can cause death. Ammonia anhydrous can cause death, and I think that is the kind of distinction that could be applied. Thank you,
counsel. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.
Thank you.